me to the experimental operations. And I said there's two motivations for that. One was as a target for acclimatization, and that's what we talked about on Friday. And the other was as a target for attempts to interpret quantum mechanics in a realist way. And so I'm going to start talking about realism today. So here I'm just reminding you of what we found in the operational framework, that what density operators represent are preparations, and any arbitrary preparation is represented by some density operator. Similarly, with transformations and measurements, trace preserving, completely positive maps, and POVMs. And for the operationalist, they were saying, let's just not talk about the properties of any systems that might pass between preparations and measurements. That kind of talk is inappropriate. Science is not about that. But today, and for the next few days, we're going to be talking about realist approaches. So we really want to imagine that there's some system passing between these guys, and it's the properties of that system that, for example, determine what the outcomes of the measurements are going to be. So how do we do that in general? Well, the first thing is we need to assume that there's some space, mathematical space, of physical states for the system that the preparation procedure generates. So the game that we're usually going to play is we're not going to be talking about a particular realist interpretation. We're going to be talking about general possibilities for such interpretations. So often what I'm going to do is say there's some physical state space. It might be phase space. It might be some other manifold. It can be arbitrarily complicated. And we don't care. We're going to ask, what can we say in general about all such interpretations? So I'm going to draw a lot of cartoons that'll have just a single parameter on an axis like this one, labeled lambda. And by that, I'm going to mean the physical state space of your realist model, whatever it is. So it could be some much more complicated manifold, but it's useful to just, for some cases, just draw it as a single axis. So what these lambdas represent are all the physical states of the system that might come out of the preparation procedure. They're a complete description of the reality of that system. Okay, so different points are different complete descriptions. So if you say, how should you represent a preparation procedure within one of these realist models? Well, it could be that knowing exactly how you did the preparation procedure, so you for example, let some atoms out of an oven, maybe some silver atoms, and you collimated them in a certain way. You have some notion of what you did to prepare these things. Well, it could be that that tells you everything there is to know about the physical state of the system that's come out of that device. Right? You might have a model that's of that sort. But it might be that knowing those macroscopic features of the preparation doesn't tell you everything about the physical state of the system. Maybe it only leaves you knowing that it's in some subset of the possible physical states of the system, but you don't know which it is. And it might leave you knowing that certain states are more likely than other states. So the most general thing you could have would be a probability distribution over those physical states. So it's some positive distribution where if I integrate over the state space, I get one. So strictly speaking, it's a probability density here. And so what I'm saying is that that's the most general kind of knowledge you could have about the physical state, given your knowledge of how the system was prepared. Okay? So what about measurements? Well, the idea of these interpretations is that how the measurement responds is going to depend on the physical state of the system that you feed into it. So it's going to depend on lambda. But again, it might depend in various different ways on lambda. So in one kind of model, it could be that this measurement tells you exactly what lambda was. So there's a different outcome for every value of lambda. But more generally, it could be that one outcome, say outcome one, occurs only if lambda is in a particular subset of its possibilities. Outcome two occurs if lambda is in some other subset, and so on. So it could sort of carve up the space of lambdas into different subsets, and your measurement could tell you which one it is. But you can have something even more general than that, which is that the measurement might not respond deterministically to the physical state of the system that's fed into the device. So here, for example, what I'm drawing are the conditional probabilities of outcomes 1, 2, and 3, given that the physical state fed into the device with lambda. So if you look at outcome one, it says that if lambda is any of these values, then you'll definitely get outcome one. This is probability one. But if lambda is over here, you have some probability less than one of getting outcome one. And the rest of the probability is taken up by outcome two. So if you feed into the device a physical system prepared in one of these states, there's some probability you'll get outcome one, some probability you'll get outcome two. And over here, it's similar. It's a half-half probability for two and three, and so on. So that's the most general way that the measurement device could respond to the physical state of the system fed into it. Note that these probabilities could be interpreted as just ignorance. So it might be that the actual outcome depends not just on the physical state of the system you fed in, but maybe also on some variables inside the apparatus. So you know, we saw last week that the POVM, which is just a coin flip and ignores the system, it's a perfectly good measurement. And a noisy measurement you can get by mixing, say, a projective measurement with one of these coin flips. So similarly, you can imagine that there's maybe a coin in the device that actually, this outcome depends on that coin rather than depending on the physical state of the system that you fed in. Or alternatively, you could imagine that these probabilities are objective, that there's nothing in the device that determines them. So this framework allows for both those possibilities. Good. And then finally, if you want to do justice to the operational predictions, right? So remember, every operational theory, whether it be quantum theory or some other theory, specifies for every pair of preparation and measurement what the probabilities of the different outcomes of that measurement are. And so if you want your realist model to do justice to that, it had better be that this equality holds. So think, how do we interpret the right-hand side? Well, this guy here is a conditional probability. It's the probability of getting outcome K when you've measured measurement M, given that the physical state fit into the device was lambda. And you multiply that times the probability that the physical state was lambda, given that you prepared P. You integrate over lambda, and you get the overall probability of getting outcome K, given that you measured M and did preparation P. So that's just classical probability theory here. So this is what you want in a realist model. You want to say, well, we can understand where the predictions of the operational theory come from by imagining that there's some physical system that mediates information from the preparation to the measurement device. Right. So this assumption here, one way of thinking about it, is that the outcome here, this probability doesn't depend directly on P. The only dependence of K on P is through lambda. Right, so this depends on lambda, lambda depends on P. So lambda is like the messenger from the preparation to the measurement device. In the theory of Markov chains, we would say lambda screens off the preparation and the measurement. Okay, so that's the basic idea of a realist model. What about a transformation? So it's very similar. We're going to model a transformation as some change to the physical state of the system that's passed through it. That could be a one-to-one map from the physical state space to the physical state space. Could be a deterministic change. Or it could involve some randomness. So for example, here I've drawn it as a conditional probability of lambda prime given lambda. So lambda is the state you feed in. Lambda prime is the state that comes out. And the way I've drawn it here is that for different values of lambda, the distribution over possibilities for lambda prime is different. So if lambda is over here and lambda prime is very narrowly distributed about some value way out here, some high value, for this other value of lambda, it's also narrowly distributed but about here. And for some small value of lambda, it's pretty uniformly distributed over lambda prime. So this gamma, capital gamma, is a stochastic matrix. Right? And it needs to be positive because it's a probability. And it needs to be that for any lambda that I feed in, the probability distribution over lambda prime is normalized, right? So it does go to some lambda prime for every lambda. Okay, so that's how we want to model transformations in this sort of realist approach. And if I want to reproduce the probabilities of getting some outcomes in a measurement that follows that transformation, so I do a preparation, then the transformation, then the measurement, well, it'd better be that when I take my distribution associated with the preparation procedure, and I map it through this transfer functional or stochastic matrix, and I get some new, this whole thing now gives me a new distribution over lambda prime. This should be a lambda prime here. And then I multiply that times the probability of getting outcome k given lambda prime, I integrate over lambda prime, I should get the overall probability of the outcome. Questions? Yes?
In that measurements, graphs and like that, how do they derive them?
How do they derive those graphs
and like those probabilities?
These models? Well, what I'm trying to do here is describe for you the target that a realist interpreter of quantum mechanics has. What such a person has to do is say, oh, that density operator, that's going to be associated with this probability distribution. So first of all, they would have to say, here's what I think the space of physical states looks like. You know, it's this kind of manifold. Here's how I represent every density operator as a probability distribution over that space. Here's how I represent every POVM over that space. And look, when you integrate them together, they do give the quantum predictions. So I'm just describing in a very generic way the kinds of objects they're going to use to represent the preparations, measurements, and transformations. So when you say, how are they going to do this? They're going to use their imagination to try to come up with such an example. And I'll show you some simple examples by the end of the lecture. You'll get a feeling for how it works.
Not the prime there, right?
Yeah, and there should be a prime here. Sorry, that's a typo. Other questions? Okay, the last thing is what happens in a measurement if we think of it as a transformation. So remember we had this, we talked about how if I do a measurement, get an outcome, but the system is left over afterwards, then there's a set of transformations, one for every outcome. And it's basically the same, that I'm just going to have one of these conditional probabilities for every outcome, outcome one, outcome two, outcome three. So the physical state, lambda, might be mapped to lambda prime in different ways depending on which outcome I got. So that's another thing that these interpretations are going to have to do, is specify how systems update as a result of measurements. Good. Okay, so the first thing I want to do is start by talking about the interpretation that we discussed on day one, which I call the orthodox interpretation, and sort of recast it in this language, just so that we're clear, sort of our first example. Okay, so let's just consider a qubit for simplicity. So according to the orthodox interpretation, the quantum state's a complete description of reality. Modulo any global phase that you assign to the vector. But in the block sphere picture, that means every point on the surface of the block sphere is a different state of reality. So when we ask, what is that space of lambdas, the space of physical states, the answer is just the surface of the block sphere, according to the orthodox interpretation. And if you say, well, what do you know? If I know that I've done a preparation procedure for some, say, you know, the Z spin up eigenstate, what do I know about reality? Well, I know everything about reality. I have a delta function located at the north pole of this block sphere. Okay? That's how you describe, you know, knowing everything on such a space. So I'll write that as just a probability distribution for the preparation corresponding to up along the n-axis. It's just a delta function. U is just my variable that ranges over the surface of the block sphere. That's like my lambda. And it's fixed at n in this example. And then how should I think of a measurement? Well, that's a bit more complicated. The measurement now is going to be a conditional probability. So imagine I measure the basis corresponding to up or down spin along the m-axis. Well, the up state is going to be associated with a conditional probability. So this is the probability of getting up along the m-axis, given that the physical state was u. And to reproduce the quantum predictions, it has to have this form, 1 half 1 plus m dot u. So if I draw that, so this doesn't look very three-dimensional, but here's m. Here's the antipodal point to m. So the probability of getting the m plus outcome here is 0. Right? If your quantum state is located here, you'll never get the m plus outcome. If your quantum state is here, you'll always get the m plus outcome. So this is 1. And then it drops off like a cosine from that point, depends on the angle that you make with m. So you can think of this as a probability everywhere, because it's a function over the sphere, which is everywhere between 0 and 1. And if I added to it the other function, the one that's 1 over here at minus m and 0 at m, it looks like this, I would get 1 everywhere, which would tell me that no matter what the state was, I have to get one of those two outcomes. Yes?
Shouldn't we have a term, in the first, the term like delta of u plus m?
If I ask how should I represent a preparation of the state that's down along n, so the state that would be pointing here, then that would be delta u plus n. It would say,
if I do the measurement in the just the opposite direction, then.
So the way you'll see, let me show you one more thing, and then maybe I can answer your question. The way you figure out what the probability of getting the outcome up along m, given a preparation that's up along n, I suppose I could have written this n plus, is to integrate the probability of plus given u times the probability of u given n over u. And then I just multiply these guys together, integrate over u, and that's going to just leave me with this, 1 half 1 plus m dot n. And that is the expression for the overlap of those quantum states. So once I've seen this, it's clear that if I prepare the, say, the plus n state, and then I measure along n, and I ask, what's the probability of getting minus n here? Well, the overlap is 0, but it also means that when I integrate this together with this guy, I'm going to get 0, which in this picture just means that this response function here that I've drawn would be oriented not along m, but along n, and it would have probability 0 down here. So let's say that if you prepare it plus n, you'll never get the minus n outcome. Does that make it clear?
No?
Yes. Yes, okay. So in this sort of approach, where we're just re-describing things, a measurement is responding to what the complete description of reality is, which in this case is just, you know, what the block vector is, by just probabilistically either generating outcome plus or minus with probabilities that depend where you are on the sphere. So there's a point like here, for example, if instead of n being here, n were over here, then this height here is the probability I'll get the plus m outcome, and the rest of the way out, you know, 1 minus this height is the probability of getting the m minus outcome. So it just says for every complete description of reality, the outcome is not fixed, it's just probabilistically given as up or down. Okay, so we heard a lot about how this sort of approach has problems with, you know, is it deterministic or indeterministic? It seems like it depends whether you model the apparatus internally to formalism or not. It also had a quantum measurement problem. And we talked about different responses, different ways of salvaging realism and doing justice to the measurement problem. And one of those was to deny that psi was a complete representation of reality and assume that there are some hidden variables. So now I'm going to talk about those sorts of approaches within the framework I just set up. And I'm going to tell you about this distinction here. So the rest of the lecture is about realism using hidden variables. And the first thing I want to point out is that hidden variables may not be as ugly as you think. So often those are the people's natural first response to positing hidden variables. So the idea is, you know, maybe there's something there and we can't know it. And a good physicist might respond, wait, if we can never know it, then isn't it, you know, bad science to assume it's there? Like, why should we be talking about things we can never know? Isn't that more just metaphysics and speculative, and not something that, for example, if you believe Karl Popper, you could falsify in an experiment? So, you know, is that really good science? And so this is my response to that objection, which is to make reference to Plato's allegory of the cave. So this is in Plato's Republic. And he says, imagine that you've got some prisoners who have been are trapped in this cave, forced to look forward at a wall in front of them. And people behind them hold up objects which cast shadows on the wall. And so all they see are the shadows of the object. But moreover, you have to imagine that they were born there, and it's all they've ever known their whole lives is just the shadows on the wall. And Plato says, well, surely they will come to think that the shadows are the reality, because it's all they've ever known. So they will come up with a theory which says that, you know, that's the full reality. But they would be wrong, you know, that there's the reality is really the objects that are casting the shadows, and they're just seeing a particular aspect of those objects. And Plato's point was, you know, we're like the prisoners, so we think we're seeing reality, but we're just seeing some aspect of it. And hidden variable theories are a bit like that as well. So just to make the point clear, imagine you've got two of the prisoners that are having a discussion, and the one prisoner, who's a good scientist, imagine, says, look, we've been seeing all these different shadows, and I've come up with a theory, and the theory says that there's this thing called the third dimension, ooh, and objects have shape in the third dimension, and the way I explain all these different shadows is by saying, well, there's these different two-dimensional projections of this three-dimensional shape, and look, it all makes sense, right? I can have this huge compression in data just by postulating that there are these three-dimensional shapes which explain the two-dimensional shadows we see. To my mind, that prisoner would be doing good science, explaining a lot of data using a simple hypothesis. But if the second prisoner says, that's an interesting theory, I have a theory of my own which says that these shapes also have color, and the color is totally irrelevant to the shadows, but it's there, and we can never know it. The second prisoner would basically be speculating, and there would be no explanatory power to that theory, you know, the theory of colored objects. Whereas the theory of shaped objects makes some predictions, has some explanatory power. So I think often people have a knee-jerk reaction against hidden variable theories on the grounds that they're like postulating colors. But as long as they're really like postulating shapes, it's really not so bad. Yes?
But so we could have these hidden variables which may not be observable, but then isn't it possible that like prisoners we could somehow turn around and maybe that we could then somehow detect them someday?
Right. So in fact, you could go further and you could say, I'm even going to defend the color-like hidden variables on the grounds that although they don't have an explanatory power currently, if they're motivated by, you know, concerns of rationality or elegance or something like that, you might say, well, okay, maybe not today do they have explanatory power, but we could imagine that someday in the future we would overcome our limitations, we would, you know, turn around and see the objects, and then we could test my theories of color, for example. So, yeah, I agree. And I think there's a lot of hidden variable theorists who would also agree with that point of view. Other questions? Good. So one of the distinctions that's going to be critical for us in discussing hidden variables is the difference between reality and knowledge of reality. So to make things easy, I'm going to use some Greek terminology. So in Greek, ontos means reality, episteme means knowledge, and so ontic and epistemic mean pertaining to reality, pertaining to knowledge. So if I talk about an ontic state, I'm talking about the real state of affairs, the real physical state. So those different points along my lambda axis, those lambdas were describing ontic states in what I just showed. An epistemic state will be a state of knowledge. Well, what do I mean by that? It's meant to be a description of what some agent knows about reality. So to give you a feeling for that, imagine the classical case. So this is sort of an uncontroversial context in which you can make this distinction. So suppose we're doing statistical mechanics and we have classical systems. We know those classical systems are described by points in phase space, right? So if I ask you for this particular classical system over here in 1D, what's its possible ontic states, the states of reality? The answer is just all the possible points in this phase space. Once you've told me where it is in the phase space, you've told me everything there is to know about the physical state of that system. You've told me its position, its momentum, there's nothing more to specify about it. But in StatMech, we also have a different notion of state, which is I can draw a probability distribution over phase space and say, this is what I know, this distribution here is what I know about the underlying point in phase space. So you won't find anything in reality, you know, meeting the description of this distribution. This distribution describes some feature of the agent's relation to reality. It's what the agent thinks is more likely and less likely. So, you know, it's not like an electromagnetic field, right, where, you know, the functional dependence actually describes reality. Here, you know, a point that's twice as high as some other point just means the agent thinks that it's the physical state is twice as likely to be here than it is to be here. So the parameters in that probability distribution are describing something about the agent's beliefs, something in the head of the agent about the relationship between the agent and the system, and they don't describe anything in the system alone. Okay, so I'm also sometimes going to make reference to ontic and epistemic parameters. An ontic parameter is one such that if I vary that parameter, then the real state of affairs must vary. Okay? An epistemic parameter is one that if I vary it, well, then I'm varying some agent's knowledge of the world. But it could be that, you know, that knowledge could be varied in a way that the real state of affairs stays the same. Right, so an epistemic parameter, you know, I might change my opinion about the probability that it's going to rain today without any physical feature of the atmosphere changing whatsoever. Right, so then that parameter would describe an epistemic parameter. Okay, so this is a key distinction for this sort of discussion. So I thought it might be fun just to sort of pause the formal progression for a bit of discussion on this sort of stuff. So Let's start with the concept of probability. So I'll ask you, you can volunteer your opinion on this. Is probability an ontic or an epistemic concept, and why? Yes?
There's two answers. One is classical, one is quantum.
Okay, so what are the answers?
The classical one would be epistemic.
Okay, why?
In statistical mechanics, for example, I mean, the probability is fully epistemic. Okay. We're assuming that in principle, if we knew all the degrees of freedom and all the information of the system, then it wouldn't be probabilistic anymore.
Okay.
It's just that we are ignorant about some of the facts.
All right.
As in quantum, probably, it's ontic.
And when you say probably, you mean classically probably because you're ignorant.
Yeah.
okay. Other points of view?
Yeah, I mean, I would say even in quantum mechanics, it can be epistemic, because if we prepare a state where we cannot really ensure that it is exactly in that particular quantum state, because we have additional disturbances or something like that, we have the probability distribution coming from the quantum mechanical properties, and also probability because we do not really know what the quantum state is. And that is exactly what can be expressed in terms of a density matrix, where we have both kinds of probabilities.
I see. So if I wrote down a density operator that was some probabilistic weighting of some pure states, you would say, look, these probabilities should be interpreted epistemically as the agent's ignorance of which of these quantum states was prepared.
Yeah.
But if I do a measurement corresponding to this basis, and I say, okay, the probability for outcome k given that the state was psi is the overlap of psi k with psi mod squared, you'd say, that probability must be interpreted differently. It must be interpreted ontically because it's purely quantum. That's what you're saying. Okay. Other points of view? Mark?
Mine's, incredibly mathematical. But anytime you're doing probability theory, that's identical to doing standard Boolean logic. But instead of having 0, 1 as your truth value set, you actually have the continuum. So I prefer to see that just entirely as reasoning where you have uncertain truth values.
Mm.
And therefore, I would think of it as epistemic as opposed to ontic.
Okay.
Well, then on the other hand, I mean, it would be natural to think that there is actually a physical state. And it's a definite state, which we can't know, but the state is there. So this is a statement about reality.
So
in this manner, it would have to be deterministic. There is something that works.
Right.
We just can't know it. Or maybe so far we don't know how to know it.
So if this probability can really be written as an integral over some hidden variables lambda, probability of outcome k given lambda times a probability of lambda given psi, then we can say, it might have appeared that this was ontic, but really it's epistemic, because here this is just interpreted epistemically. I don't know what lambda is. given the, my knowledge of psi. And lambda doesn't fix k, so I have ignorance about k even if I were to know lambda. And all of this is just epistemic. So you could say, well, no, actually, you know, probabilities in quantum mechanics are just as epistemic as probabilities in classical theories. It's just we need to find the hidden variable interpretation such that quantum states become lack of knowledge about some underlying hidden variable. Yeah. Okay, let's take another one. I should say, by the way, that the Karl Popper was somebody who promoted a notion that there are objective chances, that there's real indeterminism in nature. And so that's kind of an ontic notion of probability. Like on the very first day when we said, according to the orthodox interpretation, there is nothing in the world that determines what the outcome of a quantum measurement would be, that is an ontic notion of probability. It's not merely that you lack some information about some degrees of freedom in the world. It's that there's nothing in the world that determines the outcome. It's really objectively and stochastic. Okay, what about correlation? Is that an ontic or an epistemic concept?
There are physical correlations. If something happens here, we know that it influences the behavior of, I mean, locally at least, the behavior of something close to it.
Okay.
So, for example, I mean, physically, but not in quantum case, this would be the case. I mean, so you tip this cup and water spills and so on. And, I mean, I acted on the cup, but it acts on the water and so on.
Right.
So there are some correlations.
Okay. Other points of view? Come back. Yes.
I say, I guess, correlation is epistemic because what the ontic part of it is the forces that influence whatever one object or the other. Whereas correlation is just a state of final kind of result, so it's knowledge about what end result happens. Whereas physically, it's actually there's like some microscopic or something interactions that we don't have to know about, I guess. We're talking about correlations.
So you're saying the interactions are somehow the ontic thing, the correlations are the consequence for our knowledge of those systems,
yeah.
Of those interactions.
Yeah, I would say correlations is nothing else but a something we look at our states of knowledge and we draw arrows between them. Those two things seem to be correlated. So it's purely an epistemic thing. We don't know if there's something really truly correlated. We can't ever tell.
Hmm.
But we can only speak about what we know about it.
So when you say we don't know if there's something truly correlated, it sounds as if you're using the adjective in the sense that it would describe a way of being. You know, two things are truly correlated, and
yeah.
They have some way of being, which means that correlation is an ontic concept.
But we don't know that, so we can't talk about it.
Maybe it's an inaccessible ontic concept.
Yeah, it's inaccessible.
I
would agree that we can probably always
yes,
say a correlation for you as an observer is always some sort of relationship between two pieces of knowledge. The question is whether or not your knowledge actually corresponds to reality. So if your knowledge can be related to reality, then the correlation can be related to reality. But so it falls back to whether probability is ontic.
Okay.
Maybe some are, some aren't.
Yep. Good point. If you say correlation is a feature of probability distributions over pairs of systems. So certain probability distributions have correlations in them and certain probabilities don't. So let's look at a couple of examples. So if I have, say, just two classical bits, A and B, So A and B are both classical bits. So they take their values in 0, 1. And then I say, look, the probability distribution over A and B is, say, probability 1/2 for A and B both being 0 and probability half for A and B both being 1. That's one kind of distribution. Another kind of distribution would be one that factorized as probability of A times probability of B, where maybe this was like a half for 0 and 1 and a half for 0 and 1. So this could be, for example, like 1 quarter, 1 quarter, 1 quarter for the cases 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. The values of A and B. So this, you would say, is an uncorrelated probability distribution because it factorizes. But this one here is correlated. And sometimes people use the term correlated to mean precisely that. I think that's sort of the closest we have to a technical definition of when two systems are correlated. And note that what it means is that if you come to learn something about A, you'll update your knowledge about B. Because if I learn, for example, that A is 0, then I immediately find out, because of my prior knowledge, that A and B are correlated in this way, that B must be 0. If I learn that A is 1, then B must be 1. But if I update my knowledge about A here, so let's say I start knowing nothing about it, and then I learn exactly what the value is, it teaches me nothing about the value of B. And so you can say, well, you know, that's the operational significance of being uncorrelated. Learning about one doesn't teach you about the other. So from that way of talking about it, it seems like an epistemic concept. Two systems are correlated if, when you update your knowledge about one, you also get to update your knowledge about the other. So is there somebody in the back who wanted to say something about correlation? No? Lance, I think you're right, that if you have a different notion of how to interpret those probabilities, not an epistemic notion, then you might think that correlation is an ontic concept as well. What about determinism?
Well, I think that's both. It depends on whether you're naive and you're saying that you can't determine something, that it's an epistemic statement. But determinism as on its own should be an ontic statement, because it's whether the system can be physically determined or not. So it goes back to the probability. You know that the probabilities inherently epistemic or complex.
Okay.
If the system is not deterministic, then there's equivalence of this being the probability being complex.
Okay. Good. So it may also depend on our interpretation of probability. Yes.
I can bring up my other point again, because if something is deterministic, you can say with certainty whether a proposition is true or false. So you would actually revert back to standard Boolean logic.
What would you say is the kind of thing that can be deterministic?
I guess I've maybe reversed the definition. Something where you have like distinct, where propositions are clearly true or false. So like I say, this will happen. It's either will or won't. There's no chance that it will and chance that it won't.
So maybe that would make sense. There may be some lack of clarity about, you know, what do I mean by determinism here? You know, because I could say, you know, whether a proposition is determined or not, you know, maybe that would fit that description better. But here I guess I mean the physicist notion of a law of motion such that, you know, the final state is fixed for a particular initial state. So the kinds of things that I'm imagining are deterministic or not are laws. And so for that kind of notion of determinism, is it ontic or epistemic?
So may you repeat what do you exactly mean by this meaning?
So, for example, Laplace said of Newtonian mechanics, it is a deterministic theory, because if you specify precisely for me what the positions and the velocities of all particles right now are in the universe, I would be able to calculate what the positions and velocities of all particles, you know, tomorrow are, and therefore it's a deterministic theory. That's Laplace's definition of determinism.
Okay, yeah, but in that sense, quantum mechanics is not
determined. Why is that?
So is it?
I can't take the, I mean, if you knew the states of all, or
yeah,
the states of everything in the universe, and then in a way you go back to the original axioms you had, and if you treated all of it as a system, then everything will evolve unitarily, and you would be able to determine everything precisely.
Right, so people usually say, the Schrodinger equation is a deterministic evolution equation you specify the wave function of the universe at one time, then you just plug it into the Schrodinger equation, and it tells you what the wave function of the universe is at a later time. So in that sense, quantum mechanics is deterministic. But others will point to measurements and say, well, if you believe the textbook axioms, then they say that nothing in the world determines what the outcome of that measurement is. And therefore, the law of motion in quantum mechanics is indeterministic, because the outcomes of measurements are not determined. So that's what we saw on the very first day, is this, this inconsistency between the determinism you get by treating the whole universe as isolated and the indeterminism that you seem to get if you treat the apparatus as an external intervention on your system. So this question of whether quantum mechanics is deterministic or not depends to some extent on how you try to resolve that conflict in the textbook axiom. The Everettian, the many worlds proponent, will say, no, it's deterministic because there's just the wave function, that's it. But a collapse theory, as we'll see next week, is something that takes the notion of indeterminism very seriously. It says, no, the true, if Schrodinger's equation is wrong, according to collapse theorists, the true equation of motion is one where the wave function at a given time does not fix the wave function at a future time. So my question is, now that we're sort of clear on what a deterministic and an indeterministic theory are, is it an ontic or an epistemic notion? I'm not saying there's a right answer, I just want you to think about it and tell me what you think. Sorry?
From this viewpoint, it is ontic.
The which viewpoint? The, like?
Well, that, I mean, collapse theory versus Schrodinger equation. And this kind of setup, if the wave function is something physical, then determinism is something ontic.
Okay, so you could say if the thing that's evolving, whose law of motion we're calling deterministic, is an ontic thing, like a universal wave function according to a many worlds interpreter, or maybe a Newtonian state according to classical physics, if we're talking about the evolution of an ontic thing, well then determinism is an ontic notion. But if we're talking, by the same token, if we're talking about the evolution of an epistemic thing, so let's say I'm doing stat mech, and I notice that I can write down an evolution equation for my probability distribution over the phase space. And lo and behold, that evolution equation is such that if you give me a probability distribution at the initial time, it completely fixes what the probability distribution at the final time is. That's true in Newtonian mechanics. Because the probability distribution just responds to however the underlying phase space points are evolving and changes accordingly. So you also have a deterministic dynamics for the probability distributions in StatMech. And so in that sense, you could say, well, determinism can also be something that describes an epistemic notion like probability distribution. So you could say, well, the determinism doesn't really, you know, it's not an ontic or an epistemic concept. It depends what you're applying it to. All right, last one. What about causality? Just for fun.
It's ontic.
You think it's not? It's ontic, sorry.
Yes.
And why?
Because if causality is true, something real should happen. It's related to my knowledge about it.
I think it has to be reinforced by the notion of locality. It's locally ontic.
What does that mean?
Well, if,
first, what do you mean by causality? Do you mean nothing is, the speed's faster than light, or?
Yes. Here I guess I meant the idea of a causal relation. You know, the idea that event A causes event B. Is that notion of a causal relation an ontic notion or an epistemic notion? I know that in relativity, causality sort of usually meant. To mean nothing travels faster than the speed of light. But I didn't actually have that in mind here. Yes?
I have actually the feeling that all the terms can be interpreted as either abstract ontic property of the world. We can assume our world, but there's no way to check that. So it's ontic, but because it's ontic and we have only access to epistemical stuff by our senses, we can claim that this is a property of the world, or we can say all these terms are properties of our theory of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we can say a theory satisfies causality, or it is a deterministic theory. And then we would not say that is really something in the world, but it's something which is useful to describe the world. And that's a slight difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't say that this is epistemic, because there's no experiment to really... maybe correlation, but correlation is a little bit strange, because we do not really know. Do you mean by that something like real correlation? Like, yeah, I do exactly what Jacob did. In a term similar to causality, or is it just that measurements are correlated in a way that,
Yeah, so I think maybe there's it's helpful to think about relations versus correlations. So if, for example, in reality, bit A has value 0 and bit B has value 1, then you could say, oh, there's a relation between them, one is, the flip of the other. It's the opposite value of the other. That's the relation that exists between them. But you wouldn't say that they're correlated, right? Because strictly speaking, if you say, here's an agent who knows that A is equal to 0 and B is equal to 1, the probability distribution they would write down would be like this, PA, PB, where P of A is probability 1 assigned to A is equal to 0, P of B is probability 1 assigned to B is equal to 1. And you'd say, well, it's factorized, so they're not correlated. So you could sort of say what's going on in reality is that there's some actual relationship between the two bits. They're related in some way. And we have ignorance of that relation. And when we say they're correlated, we're describing something about our state of knowledge of that relation. We're saying we don't know precisely what their states are, but we know that if we learn something about the first, that we can acquire knowledge about the second. So I think maybe rather than saying, underneath they're truly correlated, it might just be better to say underneath they're related in some way, and we just don't know what that relation is. Yes?
So that means we would say probability and correlation might be epistemic, and determinism and causality ontic, and maybe there's something ontic underlying correlation called relation.
Relations, right.
Okay.
Yeah, and there could be something underlying even quantum probabilities, like hidden variables, which, they really are some way.
Yeah.
And then that's what determines the outcome of it. Yeah. So I want to move on, but Lance, I know you had your hand up. Did you want to add anything to this?
I just think, you should probably reserve causality for the ontic case, because that's what it usually means. So then you can say there's a correlation, but not a causation, and things like that.
Right.
So, but I mean, you can definitely define like epistemic models for causality.
What do you mean by that?
So then you would say, we have a notion of cause and effect, so then you could then, set up inferences and then say this inference looks like a cause-effect relationship, so we'll call it a causal relationship. Based on, we have this notion of an ontic state of causality.
Mm. So Aristotle talked about something like a formal cause, which he really meant kind of an explanation. The proposition that makes some other proposition true is formal cause. So do you sort of mean it that way, that we could use the word cause in talking about inferences, or not?
Well, I was just talking about like a correlation between probability distributions, like we were talking about before.
So maybe you mean it this kind of way, that my belief that it's going to rain today might cause me to take an umbrella. So, I would say, that's a causal relation that holds between something epistemic, my belief that it's going to rain today. That's not what you meant.
No, I mean, You know, it's like when you do some sort of study and you collect a whole bunch of data and then you try to draw some conclusion about, you know, when people start doing this, they're more likely to do this, or which kind of relates to, you know, when it's cloudy out, people are more likely to bring umbrellas, and then you can say that there's a causal relationship.
Right. So, yeah, it could be a causal relationship between different beliefs that I have.
But then I still have the ontic theory that there are people out there
right.
who are upset about getting wet, so then they bring the umbrella instead of just
yeah.
looking at the outside effect, which is people like the umbrellas appear when it's cloudy.
Right. So in the context of this course, we'll sort of the things that we're talking about will never be people's brains or beliefs, and so whenever we talk about correlations, you know, we're typically going to talk about what people believe, but what their beliefs are about are not other people's beliefs, but about physical systems and their properties. So in those contexts, typically, causality is more properly considered an ontic notion than an epistemic one.
A very short question.
Okay. Well,
so your notion of causality, does it assume some kind of time ordering, or is it unrelated to any time events?
I'm not trying to espouse any notion of causality. I guess the purpose of this was just to make you think a little bit about different categories of things, you know, real things, things pertaining to our knowledge. And we have to be very careful when we're talking about any given proposal that's on the table for how to interpret quantum mechanics, that we know exactly what the proponents are saying. You know, do they believe probabilities are ontic, or do they describe ignorance? You know, what exactly are they saying? Those kinds of distinctions are going to be critical for understanding the different proposals about how to interpret quantum mechanics. All right. Let me move on to now describe for you what the difference between an interpretation, a hidden variable model that treats the quantum state, the pure quantum state, psi, as ontic, and one that treats it as epistemic. So imagine you have two preparation procedures, p psi 1 and p psi 2. They're associated with pure states, psi 1 and psi 2. If I have a realist model, that is psi-ontic, so this is just a definition of what it is for a realist model to be psi-ontic, then for all pairs of states that are distinct, so for all cases of psi-1 and psi-2 that are not equal, the distribution over the hidden variables that I associate with the preparation of psi-1 and the distribution I associate with the preparation of psi-2 should be non-overlapping. So it should look like this. Okay. So what it means is that as I vary the quantum state psi, that necessarily means that the physical state cannot stay the same. So if this is psi-1 and this is psi-2, then there may be many physical states that are consistent with having prepared psi-1, but none of them are consistent with having prepared psi-2. So the parameters in psi, according to this approach, are ontic parameters. As I vary them, I must vary reality as well. Okay? The alternative, what I'll call the psi epistemic models, are just the negation of being psi-ontic. Okay, so they're just models that are not psi-ontic. So what that means is that there has to exist some pair of distinct states, psi-1 and psi-2, such that if I look at the probability distributions for those guys, they overlap at some value of the ontic state. So if I draw it in a cartoon, it means if this is the distribution for psi-1 over the hidden variables, so here I'm imagining a two-dimensional hidden variable space, this is the distribution for psi-2, there has to be some region where they overlap, which means that as I change the parameters in the quantum state, it could be that I move from this distribution to this distribution, but that's consistent with the reality being some point here in the overlap all along. So that change in the parameter is consistent with reality not changing at all. All that might have changed is some agent's description of that reality, in which case, it's fair to say that the quantum state might merely be a feature of the agent's knowledge rather than a feature of the world. It's something that can change without the world changing at all. So first of all, is that distinction clear? It's a bit tricky. No, it's not clear. Let's see, what can I say to... So suppose I had the point of view about quantum states that was of the following sort. When you prepare the state psi, what you're really doing is you're preparing some ontic state lambda, but it's chosen at random from some distribution that looks like this. Okay. So that would, you would say, well, that's clearly a hidden variable model because there's more to say than just what is the quantum state. There's also, you know, what is lambda? It's not fixed by the quantum state. It's chosen randomly for a given quantum state. So you could say, well, that's the definition of a hidden variable model. But now you could say, well, okay, is it the case that that lambda, you know, no matter how complicated it is, does it encode psi? If you tell me where I am in the ontic state space, can I infer what the quantum state is? Because then you can say, well, the quantum state is just maybe some complicated function of lambda. It's encoded by lambda. It's fixed by lambda. And in that case, you would say, well, it's kind of like, you know, the center of mass of a set of bodies. That the center of mass is not some sort of fundamental degree of freedom, but it's definitely an ontic degree of freedom. It doesn't describe my knowledge. It's some feature of those objects. It's just some complicated function of a bunch of particles. So similarly, you could say, if psi is encoded in the ontic state, and here it would be, because for every ontic state, there's a unique psi associated with it, then it must be real. It's just some coarse-grained description of reality. But over here, if psi is not encoded in the ontic state, so if I, here's a particular ontic state in the overlap of these two guys, clearly psi can't be encoded because there's some ambiguity. When I'm in one of these ontic states, psi could be psi 1 or it could be psi 2. And therefore, it's not purely a description of reality in that case. All right, let's try to clarify it with some examples. So I'm going to show you a couple of hidden variable models, which are just for qubits, two-dimensional Hilbert spaces, and for pure states and projective measurements on those. So the first one was one that was proposed by John Bell, and then it was put into a slightly nicer form by David Merman, so I call it the Bell-Merman model. And the idea is that for a qubit, the ontic state space is a pair of spheres. So the quantum state space, or the operational state space of a qubit, is the Bloch sphere. But here we're going to imagine that the reality of a single qubit is specified by a pair of points on two spheres. So I'm going to call those u and u prime. And the theory says that if you prepare a quantum state up along the n-axis, spin up along the n-axis, then that corresponds to a probability distribution of these two spheres that looks like this. So it's a delta function at n on the first sphere. So that's just like the orthodox interpretation. But the second sphere is just totally uniform. So it's kind of like you've provided the system with some kind of dice, you know. So you start off with just this totally random distribution over the second degree of freedom. And then you model measurements in the following way. So if you're imagining a measurement of spin along the m-axis, so this is m up, and the antipodal point would be m down, that corresponds to looking at the value of u plus u prime. So you add up these two vectors, and you ask whether the inner product with the vector m is positive or not. If it's positive, then you get the plus m outcome for your measurement. If it's not positive, then you get the other outcome. So your probability of getting the plus outcome goes to zero for that case. So one way to think about it graphically is that if I look at this sphere here, which is the sphere of values of u plus u prime now, so I've gone from these two spheres down to a single sphere, which is just u plus u prime, then this measurement just asks, are you in the hemisphere corresponding to the vector m or in the opposite hemisphere? That's what the measurement does. So a quantum measurement in this case is just asking something about the hidden variables. Are they here in this hemisphere or in the other hemisphere? If I ask what's the distribution over u plus u prime that corresponds to, you know, a delta function over u and uniform over u prime, it ends up being this kind of distribution here. It's basically a cosine that has value 1 here at n and drops down to 0 at the equator, and it's 0 in the lower hemisphere. So what this model says is if you want to know what the probability of getting up along m, given that you prepared a state along n, you just ask how much of this probability distribution lies underneath this top hemisphere in the m-axis. And when you do that calculation, so you just take these probabilities times this conditional for the plus outcome given these states, and you're going to do this afternoon tutorial, what you find is you get exactly the quantum prediction. So you reproduce the quantum results in this model. And that's what you need to do if you really want to say this could be what's happening with qubits. So according to this model, there is no objective indeterminism in quantum mechanics. The outcome of this measurement is absolutely fixed by the ontic state. Once you tell me exactly what point the the ontic state corresponds to, so a point on this sphere and a point on that sphere, that fixes precisely whether this you'll get the plus or the minus outcome in this measurement. And the only reason that we don't predict that outcome is because whenever we just know that the spin is up along the n-axis, we know nothing about u prime. We're sort of in sort of the scenario of the Plato's K's perveners, where there's something we don't know. And because of that lack of knowledge, we can't predict the outcome of this measurement. Note that, according to my definition, in this sort of model, the status of the quantum state is ontic. Because what we're asked to do is to multiply the probability distributions over the hidden variables for two different quantum states. So take spin along n1, spin along n2, multiply those guys together. And the point is that although they have the same distribution over u prime, on u, they don't overlap at all. They're two different delta distributions. So their overlap is zero. And that means that the physical state here encodes the quantum state. I mean, that's sort of easy to see, that u encodes the quantum state. So clearly, according to these models, psi is part of the description of reality. It's just not the whole reality. There's some extra reality to be specified. And this extra reality is what fixes the outcomes of measurement. So you could say in this sort of model, psi is supplemented by some extra variables. But it's not itself an epistemic thing. OK, now let's consider a psi epistemic model. So this is a model proposed by Koshin and Specker in 1967. And it assumes that the state space, the ontic state space for a single qubit, is just a sphere. OK, so I'll just label that by u. But now it assumes something quite different from the last model. The distribution is just this cosine distribution. It's peaked at in the n direction. It drops off to zero at the equator relative to the n direction. So I've just written it as 1 over pi n dot u. So it's just the angle between n and u. So as u moves away from n, it drops off as the cosine. And then the measurements, again, are just asking you whether you're in a particular hemisphere aligned with M or in the opposite hemisphere. And if you do the math, you find that you get exactly the quantum predictions reproduced in this model. But if you ask, is it psi ontic or psi epistemic, you find that when you multiply the distributions over ontic states associated with two different quantum states, n1 and n2, that's like this distribution and this distribution, and they overlap. And therefore, this overlap is not zero. Therefore, just telling you what u is does not tell you what the quantum state is. If I tell you, say, you know, u is this point here, well, that's inside the support of both these distributions, so it doesn't tell you what psi was. So in this kind of model, the quantum state just describes an agent's knowledge of that deeper reality. It's not part of the description of reality itself. Now, note something interesting, that there's sort of a connection between these two models, which you could describe roughly as, take the Bell-Merman model, eliminate some gauge degrees of freedom, and you'll get the Koshin-Specker model. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is that if you look at the measurements in this model, they only depend on u plus u prime. So I could do a coordinate transformation and describe this system not by u and u prime, but by u plus u prime and u minus u prime. And what this tells me is that the outcome of your measurements does not depend on u minus u prime at all. It's totally independent of the values of u minus u prime. So you might say, well, why don't we just get rid of that variable? Why don't we just say that's not part of the description of reality? Because nothing depends on it. And you know, it's maybe like the color of the objects in Plato's cave. Nothing depends on it. We shouldn't have it in our explanation. So if you do that and you say, we're just going to consider u plus u prime to be our description, then I told you that you know, the distribution over u plus u prime that's generated by these guys is exactly this cosine distribution. And that's precisely what Koshin and Specker used in their model. So this was not noticed by Bell when he proposed his model. But in any case, it means that if you want to be economical in your hidden variable theory, then perhaps you would prefer the Koshin and Specker model to the Bell-Merman model. And that drives you to treating the quantum state as epistemic, at least for these kinds of models. I'm out of time, but what I want to do, I guess next time, and maybe I'll have to go a little bit into the lecture after that, maybe not, is give you some more evidence for why these psi epistemic approaches are kind of compelling. Why they seem to make a bit more sense with quantum mechanics than the psiontic cases. Unfortunately, we don't have any examples of these kinds of hidden variable models. So really, what I'll be describing to you in the next lecture or so is kind of an idea for an interpretation of quantum mechanics, which hasn't really been realized yet. What we're going to see in the last week are some examples of psiontic hidden variable models, like the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, which actually work. They're viable interpretations of the whole formalism. And what we're going to see for the next couple of days are just some ideas of, why it would be nice to have an interpretation like this. And I'll finish there.